Right now, homes are more affordable than they've been in decades. And Quicken Loans has a mortgage program that will help you buy that perfect home. Call Quicken Loans right now. They can even introduce you to a local real estate agent that can guide you through the process step by step. With more than 25 years of helping American homeowners, Quicken Loans makes the process as easy as possible. With a streamlined approach and proactive updates, they provide you with the certainty you need to search for the home of your dreams. And highly trained Quicken Loan specialists are standing by, ready to help you take advantage of this incredible mortgage opportunity. So give Quicken Loans a call now. Call 888-249-1425. Find out how much home you can afford. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. Nationwide licensing number 3030. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. Call 888-249-1425. That's
888-249-1425. Blog Talk Radio.
Government is not the solution to our problem. Government is the problem.
Okay, I'll let me close my intros. I have my guests on the line. Hello, Andrew.
Yeah, this is Andrew.
Hey, Andrew, how are you doing this evening?
I'm doing well. How long time on?
You're on actually right now.
Okay, then here I am.
Yeah. Yeah, here you are. Sorry about that. I saw you waiting on hold before. I'm not sure exactly how long you were, but I wasn't able to bring you on just yet. But you are Andrew Breitbart, publisher of Breitbart.
Yes? Hello? I have to call in.
Hey, Andrew, can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, sorry, technical difficulties as always, it seems, right? So as I was saying, you are the publisher of Breitbart.com and all the sister sites, Big Government, Big Hollywood, Big Peace, Big Journalism, all the other sites that so many thousands of people get a lot of information from. You do a lot of investigative reporting. Tell us about how Breitbart.com started, because obviously it's a big endeavor. And being from California as you are, I know people such as yourself are not really in high demand there.
Well, Breitbart.com started in the year 2005. I'd worked with Matt Drudge for many years and kind of realized the value of the news wires in the news cycle. You know, everybody looks to ABC, CBS, and NBC and other titans of the news. Like, how do they do it? How do they find themselves in Turkey, you know, if an earthquake happens or if a revolution's happening? How do they find themselves in Indonesia? Most of the time what you see when you're looking at ABC News, when they break into coverage, is people in makeup with nice hairdos who are simply reporting to you what the news wires, the Associated Press and Reuters and Agence France-Presse or Xinhua are reporting. They subscribe to these news services. And having been involved in news aggregation for so long, I kind of realized that the mainstream media was using an act of smoke and mirrors to try and create the perception that they were all things to everybody and that they had these extensive networks that allowed for them to cover things. And so I thought, this is the beginning of a new media revolution, and I thought, why don't I try and subscribe to the news wires and create a website called Breitbart.com in my name that allowed for me to be in the same places that Peter Jennings and Katie Couric and Brian Williams and all those people were. So I knew that I wanted to create a news website and a news media empire, if you will, knowing that was the primary, you know, bar trick to create the false perception that you're everywhere. And then I wanted to make a secondary attempt to start creating original content that filled the void where the mainstream media was missing the story, and that's the harder part of what I do.
Right. Now, you're involved in so many different things. One of the things that you were involved in was the Acorn scandal and exposing that to the public, and I, for one, as a taxpayer, want to thank you for that, because I'm in New York where they have, you know, a major presence, especially downtown Manhattan and Staten Island, where I'm from, more notably known for Jersey Shore. characters. But Staten Island just had their first Acorn office open, I think, a couple of years ago. We have Planned Parenthood trying to move in now. I know Lilo from Live Action is exposing them now, and they're trying to defund, Congress is trying to defund PP. Now, is there anything else that you're working on right now, either with James O'Keefe or Hannah Giles or Live Action, anything like that, that you can let us know about?
Well, I mean, if we were, I don't think we would tell you. That's the whole point of being undercover. Well, we're working undercover at a meatpacking plant in Buffalo, New York. No, we're not. Right now, it's not just Hannah and James and Live Action and Lila Rose. What I'm trying to do is trying to find not just those people, but to try and get other people to realize how easy it is. Look, as I said in the first part about the news wires, is that the media creates the perception that they're doing their job. They're not doing their job. And what Hannah and James did was expose corruption at Acorn, every office except for one, about 10 offices. Only one had a problem with a pimp and a prostitute coming in trying to use government funds to create a government-funded brothel, and, you know, one that could get tax write-offs, and it was patently offensive. And the mainstream media said, this isn't a news story. This isn't legitimate. Well, you know what? Let the market decide. And the market did decide, and they decided that the American mainstream media's news judgment of rejecting the story was the wrong path. And if James and Hannah could have done that on $1,400, the entire budget of that investigation was $1,400. If Hannah and James can do it, then anybody in this country has the ability to take down, to take on corruption. That's my narrative. That's what I'm trying to do, is I'm trying to expose to people that the mainstream media has been a racket. It's a corrupt edifice that's going down. The mainstream media, Katie Kirk just got fired. New York Times is bleeding money, it's bleeding credibility, and there's never been a more exciting time for journalism in the history of this world. We are able to see, there's so much transparency out there, and it's because the technology is at such a place that every single person has the ability to be Woodward and Bernstein.
Right. Now, I've been somebody, I went to school for journalism, and I was disgusted by not only the professionals, quote-unquote, that I had privilege, quote-unquote, of learning from at my school, but just the sheer politics that are involved with just wanting to ask a simple question. It doesn't matter who you were interviewing, doesn't matter what it was, but the sheer politics that they infuse into the classes, and they really took it away from journalism and the greats of journalism, like Edward R. Murrow, and you know, ways to do an investigative piece, which is the heart of journalism in our nation, really. It's free press. But what do you make of people such as Hillary Clinton and now others uttering the same words, that Al Jazeera is the real news station? They're the ones we should be getting news from. What do you make of comments such as assertions such as these?
Well, I think it's kind of funny. I don't even understand how you know, that can pass any test. It's problematic. You know, Hillary Clinton is right now looked upon as being just such a wonderful person, because anybody compared to Barack Obama is wonderful, but she was the first person who said, you know, about 12 or 13 years ago, when the new media started to happen, in which the gatekeepers that were her friends and at Columbia University, at you know, the Columbia Journalism Review, and at ABC, CBS, and NBC, all of her liberal friends were starting to realize that they were losing the power to control the American narrative, and she was the one that said that we need more gatekeepers. She didn't like the idea of the Internet. She didn't like the fact that in the old guard, Newsweek killed the story about Monica Lewinsky. And then Matt Drudge came out there and reported the truth. And Matt Drudge reported the truth about Kathleen Willey. And she said, we need gatekeepers. And well, in her mind, the gatekeepers are the commissars. In her mindset, the gatekeepers are her friends, her anointed friends, her liberal friends, who would control the narrative. And technology and the American liberty-loving citizens have said, nope, we're going to do it our way, and we don't need our intellectual betters to tell us what's right and what's wrong. And I think that when you have a person who said that you need gatekeepers, meaning that there should be less citizen journalism, and then tells you that Al Jazeera is real news, shows you how great the divide is ideologically in this country.
Mm-hmm. And I think it's interesting. I track Rasmussen a lot. I think it's one of the most accurate polls out there. Now, and I see polls that poll the American people and poll politicians, and it's always the opposite view. 80% would favor tax cuts and spending cuts on the public side, society, and 75-80% of politicians will say, well, they're not getting taxed enough, and we're not spending enough, we're not doing enough. So there's always that the political class and the elites and the self-appointed elites, as you mentioned, really don't understand what the average everyday working citizen in America is dealing with, they're facing, no matter whether it's their job or whatever they profess to, but they have no idea, and the media doesn't do a good job of covering what really ails us. Instead, they'd rather go and, you know, spend hours on Charlie Sheen and yada, yada, yada. One of the stories that's not been covered or not been covered accurately, and once again with Andrew Breitbart, and I do want to talk about your new book as well, the Pickford case is one of the stories that I mean, it's been barren in the mainstream media. Tell us more about the Pickford case. Is there something here? Is there anything developing here that people should know, and that's the reason that the media is forsaking it, or is it just not enough information on it just yet?
We live in a soundbite culture. We live in a Charlie Sheen culture, and the elites like to talk about how, the end of investigative journalism has died. Well, you know, the Pickford case is pretty understandable. It's not pure rocket science, but it's not something that can easily be done in 2 to 3 minutes. John Stossel of Fox News did about a 5 to 6 minute segment on Pickford that really got down to the essence of what the problem is. His piece was called, Freeloaders, and Pickford was a segment in it. And I think he got down to the bottom of it, that this is fraud at the highest levels you can possibly imagine, that there was a case of black farmers in this country that came forward that was about discrimination at the USDA. And from what I've been able to do in my investigations, I don't think that those original Pickford farmers, the 157 or so, that said that they got bad loans or didn't get loans that they were supposed to get at the USDA, why the USDA does loans in the first place. I mean, I'm more libertarian when it comes to these things and don't think that the government should be involved in the business of regulating the winners and losers of farming. But if we are going to establish this, I don't think that black farmers should be discriminated against, and I think that there's a pretty good case that black farmers were discriminated against. So coming from that position that black farmers were discriminated against, I question why, in this case where the USDA accepted responsibility, settled with the farmers, and the Justice Department hashed out an agreement, there were 157 black farmers. The advocates of Pickford said, there would be at most in this class action suit 2,500 to 3,000 people who would be paid. There were only 18,000 black farmers in the entire country at that time. So they thought that 3,000 out of 18,000, one-sixth of them, would be potential claimants in the Pickford class action suit. So when Pickford 1 ended, there were 22,500 claimants. There's something wrong right there, isn't there? I mean, that's basic math, right? There are more people now lining up at the trough to try and get paid money through Pickford. That's a problem, right?
Right. Absolutely.
Okay.
And
okay, well, that's just Pickford 1. And so Barack Obama is running for the presidency in the year 2007. Pickford was supposed to be over. I mean, if you get involved in a lawsuit and the lawsuit is over, wouldn't you be upset if a lawyer called you up and said, "Hey, we're gonna start charging you again. I know we settled for, $1 million here, but, the people want more from you. No, we settled this lawsuit. But what Barack Obama did single-handedly at the behest of the Pigford advocates who were making a lot of money off of this, class action attorneys who were making tens of millions, hundreds of millions of dollars off of the billion, 1.5 billion is how much Pigford One was for. These class action attorneys said, wow, nobody paid attention to the fact that more people got paid than there are black farmers. Let's do this again. And in the year 2007, the Pigford advocates went to President Senator Obama and said, we can help you get elected in the rural South if you sign on to Pigford. What did signing on to Pigford mean for him? He sponsored legislation that allowed for 72,000-plus late filers to come in. Okay, 22,500 is how many there were in the first Pigford, which was over 4,000 more than there are actual black farmers in the country. And Barack Obama wants to now give $50,000 checks to 72,500 new people, none of whom were farmers in the first place. The actual black farmers of Pigford never got paid for the most part. They got screwed over here. But they created a class called the Attempted to Farmer, and all you had to do was fill out a form and say, I attempted to farm between 1983 and 1997, and you had to take their word at it. And I'm telling you, Pigford is about 97% to 98% fraud. It's redistribution of wealth, and it's sold within the black churches and fish fries throughout the South as reparations, and it's how Barack Obama wielded the reparations movement in order to get a strong turnout of the rural black community. It's a huge scandal.
Right. And this is corruption at its height, obviously, because it's basically pay for play, and it's just redistribution of wealth. It's basically a payoff, and in some cases, it's undocumented. In a lot of cases, and, the media's not covering it.
They're not. But this week, one of the two architects of Pigford, Al Pyres, is made, who admits to having made over $10 million in it, just a scam artist of the highest order, who was the subject of the John Stossel piece, and John Boyd of the National Black Farmers Association are teaming together for a copycat lawsuit called Love versus Vilsack, and that's basically the women's farmers. And behind the women's farmers are the Hispanic farmers, and behind the Hispanic farmers are the Native American farmers. And so in Pigford 1 and 2, we're talking about $2.75 billion going to people who have never farmed a day in their lives, or the majority have never farmed a day in their lives. And right now, the two guys who invoked, oh, racism and, black people, have been suffering, have been suffering as a means to justify the fraud, and nobody wants to touch that story because everybody's so politically correct in this country and fearful of being called a racist. Now you have the success of it and the fact that nobody was willing to call it out. Now you have these copycats. Billions of dollars are going to go towards women who will claim on a form that they attempted to farm, and they're going to get $50,000. It's redistribution of wealth going towards a female constituency. It's, the American – if you can't fight this when it's this blatant, then we're really going to have a hard time fighting, entitlements and stuff, because and Medicare and where fraud really exists at a high level. If you can't call this stuff out for what it is, it's so naked, it's so blatant, it's so unjustifiable, it's so provably true. The numbers just don't add up, and yet we're the only ones out there reporting it, and the mainstream media wants to ignore it.
And it's a shame for the mainstream media, because for a long time they were really looked at by tens of millions of Americans and even people on the international level as really the height of sophistication, because, as you mentioned before, it seemed like they were everywhere. Whenever something breaks, whenever, glass is broken in Turkmenistan, it seemed like somebody was there. Meanwhile, it was, like you said, smoke and mirrors. So the media has portrayed themselves as something that they're not. People are seeing through it. Fox is growing. you know, people were able to capitalize on this because the market for truth and exposing government and exposing corruption and everything was there. And now we got guys like Eric Bolling, guys such as yourself, Glenn Beck, who really made a life on this. And I, for one, you know, as a lover of free press and free speech, want to thank you on it. And we can go about this all day. But I really want to get into your new book. It's coming out this week, April 15th, I believe, is the date, correct?
Yeah, it comes out on Friday, I think. A lot of people I know have already ordered it. That's what we said it was, but people have read it already and called me up and said, thank you for writing it. So I guess if you ordered it from Amazon.com or Barnes & Noble, it's already out. And Mark Larson, a San Diego talk show host that I appear on frequently, called me up during the middle of my dinner last night and said that he got it and that he loved it and he wants to have me on this week. So it's out there, but I guess technically it's not out until tax day.
Right. And, it is on Amazon. It's actually in stock now. People can see it right on my site, and they can click a link out, and they can purchase the book. And I encourage them to purchase the book because, you know, you're doing a great job of what you're doing. I'm not saying that because you're on the show. I don't feel I have to kiss up to any of my guests. I've had plenty of high-profile guests. And the reason I pursued you for such a long time is because of what you have to bring to the table and what you're trying to do and what you are doing. So I appreciate that. Tell us about your book. Tell us about what you wrote in it. I mean, as much as you can, obviously. I want you to give it away. I want people to purchase it and read for themselves. But what's at the heart of the book? What were you trying to articulate to people?
Well, one thing I believe in is only write a book when you have something to say. There are a lot of authors out there that write a book every 3 weeks because there's a market. Last book I co-wrote, it was called Hollywood Interrupted. And it was an attack on celebrity culture after 9/11. And I saw, as America was united, these narcissists that are my neighbors in Los Angeles, you know, couldn't handle the fact, A, because they're leftists, but B, because they're narcissists, couldn't handle the fact that the country was unifying. And they were at the forefront of disuniting this country. And I'm just pissed off. And I wrote a book that I think you should all read, too. I can't believe I'm selling Hollywood Interrupted 7 years after the fact. But I just wanted to say, screw you, Hollywood. How dare you do to this country after they have provided you such a wonderful place and platform to make more money than you deserve in order to denigrate the greatest country on the planet. And so this book is 7 years later, and I was a behind-the-scenes guy. I did the Drudge Report and other stuff like, you know, that. And I've emerged sort of as a public person who has basically declared war against the old media, who's declared a culture war against the left in mainstream media, in Hollywood, and against academia. My next site's going to be called Big Education, where we're going to go after the professors and the unions. I've declared war, I admit it, and I'm using media as a means to fight this war. It's a war for liberty. It's a war for freedom. It's a war against the statists, and it's a war against the left. I'm not objective. I am a former liberal, and so I'm like an ex-smoker. And my book shows you how I went from a default cultural liberal in the west side of L.A., going to school with the fanciest of the Hollywood executives and the stars, and I was a go-along-to-get-along liberal, and I slowly started to see the error of my ways. I started to realize the degree to which I had no chance. You know, when you saturate in the mainstream media, when you saturate in the Hollywood movies, I was a default cultural liberal. And I talk about how the Clarence Thomas hearings were the beginnings of my awakening, where I saw that this black man, I existed in the realm of political correctness. I existed in the realm where I thought, you can't even criticize a black person. You need to give them a handout. You need to do anything you can to show to that individual or to that group that you are going to acquiesce because of the wrongs that have been done to black people historically. That's where I came from. I think George Bush said it best when he called that the soft bigotry of lowered expectations. But that's where I came from. That's what I believe to the core of my being. I would have given my money my bank account, my pants, my shirt to an African American. It wasn't based upon merit. It was based upon guilt, pure and simple. And I watched the Clarence Thomas hearings, and I thought, wow, this guy must have done something really, 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 really bad in order to get Peter Jennings and Tom Brokaw and the National Organization for Women and the NAACP to say, well, all these politically correct rules apply, but they don't apply to Clarence Thomas. So I pulled up a chair, and I watched the entire hearings waiting for them to take this grotesque, obvious sexual harasser down. And I watched the entire hearings, and I kept waiting for a moment where the evidence would add up to the accusations against him. And I watched the National Organization for Women say, this man is the worst thing in the world. I'm like, okay, well, give me the evidence. A pubic hair, mentioning that there's a pubic hair on a Coke can is not sufficient evidence to prove to me that this guy is a bad guy. And then I watched white liberals like Ted Kennedy. I'm like, wait, Ted Kennedy is sitting in judgment of Clarence Thomas on the issue of sexual harassment? Is this some type of Saturday Night Live routine? And I watched how the NAACP silent on this, and I watched that the mainstream media allowed for them to attack him mercilessly, and nobody came to his defense. I said, what's wrong here? What's wrong with this picture? Why are they attacking him, and why are none of the politically correct organizations like NOW and NAACP and the mainstream media defending him? And now I know what it was. I call it the Democrat media complex, and it's the natural alliance of the Democratic Party and the mainstream media. And when they want to target somebody Saul Alinsky style, Rule 13 style, this is what they do. And they destroy their lives, and they destroy Sarah Palin's life, and they try to – everything is fair game against a conservative who is about to get power. And once I realize that that's how media is done, once I realize that it's feigning objectivity while using the media as a means to attack conservatives, I said, that's inherently unfair. These people are bullies, and my entire media resources are put towards going after those bullies, mostly in the political media space.
Well, you've done a great job so far. The best part of it is when somebody comes there, puts their thumb in the eye of somebody that they don't like with facts. And, you know, you mentioned Alinsky, and I've listened to you so many times on Hannity and Beck and all these other shows. I frequent your site a lot because I like investigative journalism. But following you on Twitter is literally a comedy act. It's funnier than any Charlie Sheen 10-minute clip or anything that he could say or do or anything like that. You not only retweet everything that's said against you, all the heinous words and all the I hope you die, I hope you contract, you know, terrible diseases, all this kind of stuff. You continue to do it. There's a part of me that says that thinks that you can't sleep at night unless you can, you know, you retweet another couple of them before you go to sleep. So it's really funny to watch on Twitter.
It's actually true. I mean, I have learned not to fear my detractors. I've learned to yearn for those moments. I targeted Media Matters. I knew that these guys were Stalinists. I knew that they were totalitarians. I knew that their goal was to shut up dissent. Listen to me. I created the Huffington Post, not because I agreed with the Huffington Post, but I believe in a country where there's more voices, not less. And so the idea that I would create for Arianna Huffington, the Huffington Post, a venue for left-wing vitriol, I was like, I'm not intimidated by their point of view. I think that the best ideas win in a free market of ideas. And so the very idea that the Huffington Post would shut me down, the very idea that Arianna Huffington would perpetuate a campaign against me on the basis of Color of Change, Van Jones, who I had vanquished, and exposing him as a commie, and all sorts of other things, or that Acorn would join up in an alliance with Van Jones, who Acorn and Van Jones were both vanquished by me, that Arianna Huffington would use the Huffington Post and Media Matters to try and shut me down, to try and take advertising off of Fox News, to try and shut down Glenn Beck, to try and shut down Bill Bennett, to try and shut down Lou Dobbs. This is my goal. It's to expose that the left are cultural Marxists that they're totalitarians, that they're bullies, that they want to shut people up. Because once the American people, who are freedom-loving people, start to realize that the political enemy is not the Democratic Party of your grandmother, that this is a bunch of Stalinist totalitarians, then my job is done. That's all I care about. I want to expose the left for what it is, and they are nefarious. They're single-minded in their pursuit of snuffing out liberty in this country, and the power that they have been able to hold is because of their smarts and their diligence and their pursuit of controlling the narrative through our cultural institutions such as academia, Hollywood, and the mainstream media. That's why I focus on that and less on Harry Reid and Nancy Pelosi.
Well, it's interesting, and you helped me segue. I do want to stay on the issue of the topic of Media Matters and Glenn Beck, but it's interesting that they're using this, and it's typical war strategy or fighting strategy, where they use these same elements that people love and have fought for and have bled for in this country, and use that against our people. That's the same thing that our enemies, external and internal, are doing with us. And for our media and for our politicians and for our, you know, people such as that, that are supposed to represent the American public nationally and internationally, it's disgusting to me, because, you know, I've been called so many different things just inherently just by being either a member of the Tea Party or being this, being that, being a Republican or a conservative. I've been labeled so many different things, and for what reason? You know, nobody knows me. I'm an immigrant. I'm Jewish. So, you know, already that way people look at me and say, how are you Jewish and conservative? And, you know, all these labels that they throw out there, they have controlled the narrative for so long, and now it's finally being broken. And people such as yourself and Glenn Beck have done a great job of bringing this to the public. Your buddy Glenn Beck has announced that at year's end he'll be leaving his obviously amazingly successful show on Fox News to pursue other means. I think he's going to be completely online, which is better for him. It's a better opportunity to make money and spread the message quickly. If you were to be approached for that role, would you take it?
I'll say this. I was followed around for the last year by a documentarian, and I said, why would somebody want to follow me around? I mean, what I do is, you know, blogging and working with citizen journalists. The second that they started to follow me at CPAC of 2010, there was action. I got into battles in the lobby with Max Blumenthal and Tommy Christopher and Mike Stark, and it was just combative. And then they went and followed me at Searchlight, and the cameras caught union guys throwing eggs at the Tea Party van. And then they went to Right Nation out in the suburbs of Chicago. And you remember the video where I confronted the union people and I asked them, what does your sign mean? Do you know it? You even know why you're here? And they ended up dissembling. They ended up leaving in their vans because I had exposed that they were just basically AstroTurf, SCIU, and were just chanting things such as, you know, stop the hate, stop the hate, and then they started calling me a homosexual. All that stuff happened on video with the cameras following me. And when I'm on television in a studio, I feel constrained. I feel much more alive and effective when I'm out there on the streets confronting people, confronting ideas, being provocative. I don't know if you saw when I went to the anti-Coke rally in Palm Springs on my rollerblades, and I got people on tape to say crazy things like, we want a revolution, we want a revolution. Right. What type of revolution, I asked. He said, you know what I mean, like in Egypt.
Yeah.
I think I don't feel so comfortable in a studio. I don't feel so comfortable constrained by four walls. I want to go out there and do something different. So I don't think I would say yes unless they allowed for me to be what I am. And I'm a provocateur. I admit that.
I'm trying to expand the conservative movement. I'm trying to expand the news world. I'm trying to make it so that it's not as predictable as it looks on TV. There are conservatives that I know in Hollywood who are punk rockers, who are top comedians, who are top producers, and they are so fearful of expressing themselves. And I'm trying to create a world, a bridge for those people to walk so they can join me in this battle. And I don't think that that battle is going to be won with a straight talk show where you're preaching to the choir.
Well, again, you've done such a great job of exposing so many different people. That scene down in Palm Springs, and it's funny, as you mentioned with your rollerblades, I'm surprised none of them threw a stick in front of you and tried to make you fall, but whatever. I'm glad that you weren't hurt, obviously. But you are bringing a lot of stuff that people haven't seen, and, you know, socialists have risen before. In the 1920s, 30s, we had Nazi rallies out in Madison Square Garden. Glenn Beck, brought that on the show and really kind of expounded on that last year. And, you know, it's just people never thought that it was around, because we had people like Reagan, we had people like Bush, and we had people like Clinton who really hid his true nature and his agenda. So we never really thought that we were under any kind of attack internally. And we all know that forces from the outside can never destroy America, because we're just that powerful, we're just that resolute. But from the inside is where we're getting attacked now. And just as, you know, I just want to, I'm not taking up a lot of your time, but just the last thing that I want to really focus on is, what do you think our biggest challenge is as citizen patriots? You know, again, is it the media? Is it the politicians? Is it
It is the threat from within, and it's very funny. You know, the left, you know, the media says, you know, when we call out the left as socialists, you're not allowed to say that. Why? Why am I not allowed to call a socialist? Yet the mainstream media calls the Tea Party racist. Wait, you're not allowed to say that. Don't you have to prove that? Look, the media is so central to the problem. They frame narratives. Absent evidence, they frame the Tea Party as racist. Why? Because they saw that this thing was a growing juggernaut. It needed the fake N-word story where Congressmen Carson and Lewis from the Congressional Black Caucus made up from whole cloth. They needed that to be true. And so after a year and a half of trying to frame the Tea Party as racist without having any substantive evidence, they finally got their centerpiece of their strategy in Congressman Carson saying, "We walked out of the Cannon House step building," and then they surrounded us, a mob of 400 people, and they were going to throw rocks at us, and then they started to yell the N-word 15 times. 15 people yelled the N-word at us 15 times, and then the police came and took us away. Well, it was a lie. I proved it was a lie, not only by offering $100,000 that nobody ever came to get, by saying, out of all those people, doesn't anybody have any evidence that the N-word was said once? Not 15 times, once. And they shut up. The people who accused the Tea Party, who were hogging the microphones and who wanted that lie to be leaving the mainstream media that night, that week, when I said, show me the proof, let's investigate this thing, they went into hiding. And when they told me, when the Associated Press, Jesse Washington, said, well, the absence of video doesn't mean that it didn't happen. And he said it happened at the top of the Cannon House step building, and the video that everybody has seen happened near the Capitol. So you can't prove that it didn't happen because people didn't come to retrieve the $100,000. I said, Jesse Washington, I'm going to go find the videos that it didn't happen. And we found four videos of Congressmen Carson and Lewis walking down the steps, briskly, unobstructed, not surrounded. No police came to help them. And Congressman John Shattuck, white Republican congressman, was walking a beat behind them. We disproved that event didn't happen. I've gone to ABC, CBS, and NBC and said, hey, that was a huge, huge lie that people still believe. My neighbors still believe. They say, oh, come on, the Tea Party's racist. You know how they yelled the N-word at Congressman Carson Lewis. No, it didn't happen. It didn't happen. It didn't happen. I've got four videos. The mainstream media refused to show that video because not only do they not want the truth to come out, which is what their whole role is supposed to be, is because Congressman Carson and a civil rights legend, John Lewis, would be implicated. And beyond that, the Democratic Party strategy that day was Nancy Pelosi, the Congressional Black Caucus, to walk through that crowd fishing for an incident. And when they didn't get it, they made it up. The Democratic Party, in collusion with the mainstream media, were trying to malign the Tea Party. We're trying to malign millions of Americans who are doing what the Constitution grants them to do, the right to redress the government for their grievances. And when the mainstream media colludes against its own citizens to malign them in a way that they will not malign our true and stated enemies, radical Islamists who would kill Americans and who would attack Americans for their very liberties, we have a problem with the mainstream media. That is my goal, to take down this facade of objective journalism in this country. It does not exist.
Well, I'm glad that somebody's doing it because, again, I don't care what side of the aisle anybody's on. If you only stand up for your people that support your opinion or support your view or doing what you want to do, if it's not just, it's not right, and you saw this during the Clarence Thomas hearing. That's what was your realization, your epiphany, saying that, you know, these guys are on the same side as me on a political aisle, political spectrum, but they're doing something inherently wrong, and that's sacrificing their values and principles and all the things that they espouse, that they stand for. Meanwhile, they're, you know, you saw right through it after that, and now you're on this huge campaign against them. Is there, once again, with Andrew Breitbart, author of the new book, Righteous Indignation, Excuse Me While I Save the World, which I'm assuming is a play on the liberal mentality that they can save everybody and stop the world's ills and stuff like that.
Thank you for noticing the humorous origins of that title.
I do appreciate you writing this book again. It is available on Amazon. It's the release date for the traditional ways to buy to purchase a book, Borders, Barnes & Noble, I guess Walgreens, Walmart, whatever, is April 15th, tax day, which is also the release of Atlas Shrugged. I suggest you check out, buy the book, go see the movie. The producer will be on my show on Wednesday. Or you can just get on Amazon right now. You can probably have it by Tuesday, Wednesday, if not sooner. Andrew Breitbart, thank you so much for coming on. I do want to have you on again because there's so much. I have a feeling that James O'Keefe, you, and so many other citizen journalists that you're working with, and they're just doing it independently, are about to bring up so much more because there's so much corruption, so much power that the liberals have been able to gain, you know, being that they're only 18 to 25%, depending on what poll or whatever is surveying them. But they've been able to amass so much power within academia, within politics, within everything. I know there's more coming. I can't wait to see it because, again, I love investigative journalism. Go ahead.
Well, what I would like to say is that I do play a lot off of the left's tactics, and I use them against them. And there is a lot of wisdom in their activism, and their constant Alinsky-like pursuit of their political enemies. And one thing that the left has said over and over is that all politics is local, and that is, nothing could be more true than that. And that stands truthful as relates to new media. And people say, oh, okay, I've got a professor, I'm at a small university in southern Florida, and my teacher is a math teacher, and he just berates conservatives in math class. Okay, film that. I'm going to launch big education. That would be huge. And next thing you know, that goes on my site. Like, why would anybody want to look at that? Because it's representative of what every college is doing. And that's the same thing with Acorn. It represented something bigger than just that it was this group called Acorn. I called it the Abu Ghraib of the Great Society because I thought in so many offices in an organization that's supposed to represent helping minorities, helping poor people, that's how you help poor people? Trying to help aid and abet them, trying to establish a prostitution ring with 14 and 15-year-olds, it doesn't matter how small it is. I mean, if you've paid attention to what's going on in Bell, California, the corruption that happened at that local level, this is all new media is local.
you come to me. If you've got a fire department that's on the take, if you've got a city councilman who's taking bribes, that's national news in this environment right now, and the mainstream media will not cover it. So if you have a blog or if you have a videotape or if you want to get this beyond your local media, come to me. That's what James and Hannah did. That's what Live Action and Lila Rose did, is that my goal is I want to take your small story and I want to make it big and I want it to have an impact, because if we don't start taking on this corruption at the small level, at the large level, we're going to lose this country.
Right. And one of the other things to focus on, and I've actually gotten tips on this, I don't know if you heard of it, but a lot of stimulus money is going to worker training. And what we've seen, at least locally here in New York, worker training is actually kind of a socialist platform for organizing and getting the unemployed organized. So we know how important that is to the left and to the socialists out there, the 99ers and all of them. I don't know if that's something you guys are working on already. If not, there's a tip for you all the way out here from New York. Because we've seen it there. We didn't get any cameras in there yet, but that's something you might want to might look into if you're not already.
Well, I highly recommend that you become my. I will anoint you. You are now officially working with me, and the pay isn't so hot.
I'm sure it's like working for government, except more rewarding.
Uh huh.
Andrew Breitbart, once again, thank you so much for coming on. Author of the new book, Righteous Indignation, Excuse Me While I Save the World, available on Amazon right now. You can get it from my site. And you could also go, Breitbart.com doesn't have a link up on it yet, does it?
I think it has a big government and big Hollywood at the top of the marquees where we put the top stories. I'm selfishly pushing myself right now. Please help me save my family's mortgage. And by Righteous Indignation, Excuse Me While I Save the World.
Wonderful. You capitalists are all the same.
Well, thanks a lot. Thanks for the opportunity.
I appreciate it. I had a great time. Thank you for coming on.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.